Why you are busy enjoying your lunch, why you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening, we ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia, make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Very good afternoon to you, Namibia, and to all our listeners joining us from every corner of the country and beyond. Thank you for tuning in to Eagle FM, the station where conversations count. I am your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and you are listening to On the Reading News Analysis, your weekday deep dive into the stories shaping Namibia's economic, social, and governance landscape. Now, it's Thursday, the 13th of November, 2025, and as we near the end of another eventful week, we continue to unpack the developments driving Namibia's growth from the decisions made in boardrooms to the realities unfolding in our communities. Now, here on the Reader, we don't just report the news, we dig deeper. We analyze the context, challenge the narratives, and connect the dots, bringing you balanced, evidence-based insights into the issues that define our nation's present and shape its future. Every weekday from 1300 hours to 1430, we bring in Namibia's most important conversations, featuring expert commentary, exclusive interviews, archived perspectives, and of course, your voice that keep our national dialogue alive. Now, because in a world overflowing with information, understanding remains our most powerful tool. So as we bring you today's program, we'll highlight key national stories, explore their wider implications, and hear from those working to influence policy, drive innovation, and strengthen our democracy. Remember, you can catch On the Reader on all Eagle FM frequencies, stream us live via the Eagle FM app, or join the conversation on our WhatsApp channel for exclusive clips, insights, and behind the scenes moments. Now, wherever you're joining us from, your car, your office, or the comfort of your home, stay tuned, stay informed, and stay curious, because here on the Reader, Namibia doesn't just listen, Namibia comes to think. Now let's jump right into these top stories. The Bank of Namibia, in partnership with the Ministry of Industrialization and Trade, the Ministry of Labor, Industrial Relations and Employment Creation, and the United Nations Namibia, officially launched the Diagnostic of Informality in Namibia on Tuesday, that is the 11th of November, held under the tagline Evidence to Action for an Inclusive Economy. The initiative represents a significant milestone in understanding and strengthening Namibia's informal sector, a critical component of the country's socio-economic landscape. Now, according to the Namibia Statistics Agency, the informal economy employs a large share of the population, particularly women and youth who engage in small-scale trade, services, and production activities. The sector serves as a vital safety net, providing livelihood for thousands and high unemployment rate amid high unemployment rate, which currently stand above 20%, and helping to reduce the burden on government welfare systems. Now, the yearly launch diagnostic aims to provide evidence-based insights into the size, the structure, and the dynamics of informality in Namibia. It will inform policies designed to promote decent work, improve access to finance, enhance productivity, and strengthen social protection for informal workers and micro enterprises. Now, by translating data into actionable strategies, the Diagnostic of Informality in Namibia seeks to guide the country toward a more inclusive and sustainable economy, one that recognizes and supports the contributions of informal workers to national development. Now, studying the informal economy in Namibia is essential for developing informed policies that effectively support informal workers and small businesses. A significant portion of the Namibian population relies on the informal sector for their livelihoods, thereby alleviating some of the pressure on government resources to provide for the unemployed. Now, given the country's high dependency ratio, strengthening and formalizing this sector can play a crucial role in enhancing economic participation, promoting self-sufficiency and contributing to a sustainable national development. Now let's take a listen to Michael Mohavindu, who is the Executive Director in the Ministry of Finance and the Chairperson of the National Working Group of Informality, was speaking at the event.
Today is not merely the launch of a report. It is the culmination of a profound journey, a journey that has reshaped how we understand a significant and important constituent of Namibia's economy, and speaking personally, has fundamentally transformed my perspective as a policymaker. For too long, the conversation about the informal economy has been one of silence, of oversight, and of an invisible workforce. We have allowed a narrative to persist that treats this sector as a side activity, a temporary measure, a nuisance, or a shadow economy, as they call it. Some also call it the black economy, black underground economy. To date, when we look at the data, it tells a different, undeniable story. This sector is not a side economy. It is a pillar of our national life, as attested by the number of almost more than half the house that showed that they were raised by an informal economy actor or actress. It is the engine room where, as the deputy governor has informed us earlier, that an estimated 58% of our workforce finds their livelihood. In addition, it is also important that in my speech I mentioned that it contributes a significant portion of our GDP that demands our respect and full integration. In 2024, when Cabinet approved the National Informal Economy, Startups and Entrepreneurship Development Policy, or what we call NISEP, that policy indicated that the informal economy by 2023 was estimated to be 24.7% of GDP, almost a quarter, which represented approximately 8 billion at GDP power purchasing prices levels, and latest indicator of 2025 reached that up to 26.5% of GDP, representing approximately 13 billion US of GDP at PPP levels. Roughly, the overall GDP at PPP levels is around 49 billion US. So that really tells you that this is a major economy that we are dealing with. And that's why I always say it's the biggest segment of the private sector. It is a space where women, who make up the majority of informal workers, build up more than half of all informal enterprises, where youth build their first businesses, and where resilience survives in the absence of safety nets. This report, the National Diagnostic on Informality in Namibia, is therefore a mirror we hold up to ourselves. It reaffirms a truth that we can no longer ignore. Namibia cannot transition to shared prosperity while half of its workforce and entrepreneurs transitions daily between survival and exclusion. Equally, our country cannot effectively diversify this economy without scaling up and propelling and incubating in the most sustainable manner the bedrock of our indigenous entrepreneurial capital, which is the informal economy. Ladies and gentlemen, when we began the work of the National Working Group, we deliberately chose not to commission a study from behind a desk. We opened a national conversation. We stopped speaking about the informal economy and started speaking with the people who were engaged and involved in it every day. We listened to the stories of the street vendors in Windhoek and across the country. We listened to their stories of how constantly facing the threat of eviction, yet they continue rising before dawn to provide essential goods. We spoke with the taxi drivers who navigate our cities, the backyard mechanics who keep our transport running, and the informal food vendors whose small survivalist operations feed our communities and fund the education of our future generation. Their experiences are marked by immense challenges. One is lack of security, the operating in restricted zones, often without legal protection or safe working spaces. We are all aware of these issues. There is also financial exclusion. There is limited access to formal credit for them, insurance products, as well as social protection in general. There is also a regulatory burden facing a complex, at times, unfortunately, a very punitive regulatory environment that treats them as a problem to be controlled and managed, not a partner to be empowered. The process has deepened my appreciation for the sheer grit and entrepreneurial spirit of the Namibian people. It has aligned our policy with the determination to recognize, protect, and unlock the real economy that leads beyond glass buildings and corporate regulations and dark suits and ties. This diagnostic report is therefore not an end. We believe it is a powerful beginning. It is an essential first step in a journey from research to reform.
Great news! Impact just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
In a journey from research to reform. The power of this work lies not only in the diagnosis, but also in the roadmap. And I urge everyone to read that roadmap. It's a blueprint that speaks to legal reforms, inclusive finance, fit-for-purpose business registration, special justice, a major issue, as well as digital inclusion. It is a roadmap that recognizes that transitioning to formality is not a punishment, but is an invitation into dignity, productivity, and protection. And I stand here today confident not because this report is perfect, but because it was not built in isolation. It was built across ministries, labor unions, cooperatives, development partners, and most importantly, through the voices of the people whose life it must serve. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this work would not have been possible without the collective effort of many. Firstly, to the government of the Republic of Namibia for funding and backing this process from the start. Equally, as I mentioned earlier, for the government to have approved in late 2024 the NISA policy, which is actually the precursor for future legislative reforms to effectively ensure sustained and formalized support to the informal economy. To the Central Bank, Bank of Namibia, who was not just serving as a secretariat, but also demonstrated what it means for a central bank to champion inclusive development with purpose and humility. To the UN system in Namibia, for providing and proving that blended financing and technical cooperation are not slogans, but they are actually instruments for real change. To our consulting partners, Synergy BAC, Genesis Analytics, the UN Habitat UNETAC project, that just not deliver a report, but also a standard of excellence of how future reports should look like. And to the representatives of the civil society, labor unions, informal sector organizations and the private sector who stayed at the table even when conversations were becoming uncomfortable. But above all, our deepest gratitude goes to the traders, the farmers, the taxi drivers, the hairdressers, the cooks, the mechanics, the welders, the seamstresses, such as my mother, although she was not interviewed, she's too old now, and the street vendors who opened their lives to us. This work would have not been written from behind a desk. Really, it needed dust, it needed voices, it needed walking around with reality and to experience those lived reality. As we wrap up this project, ladies and gentlemen, I want to remind us again that this report is not the conclusion of a study. It is the beginning of a movement. If we do act with the agency and the conviction that this moment demands, Namibia can be among the first African countries to move from managing informality to transforming the informal economy into a recognized, productive, and a protected, incubated pillar of national development. And so today, I ask all of us, government, regulators, financiers, local authorities, NGOs, INGOs, and development partners, let us treat this roadmap not as a policy reference, but as a national commitment. The informal economy actually does not need our sympathy. It needs policy. It needs supportive legislation. It needs reform. It needs investment. Above all, it needs our respect. Let us leave this room celebrating a document only, but let us rather leave this room a united decision that, firstly, Namibia will no longer build two economies, one that is seen and one that is just seen as being surviving. Secondly, that the people who feed us, move us, clothe us, and build for us will never again stand outside of the gate of economic protection and policy recognition. Today, we honor them with data in that wonderful report. Tomorrow, we must actually honor them with delivery. I thank you.
We are back. Of course, I do want to appreciate Michael Muhavindu, that is the executive director in the Ministry of Finance, for speaking. I picked up some very important aspects that he spoke, especially towards the end. He said the informal sector does not need a PTO, you know, but it needs policy, supportive reform, registration, and investment. Now, joining me in studio right now is Peter Sen Nyonange. He is a qualified teacher, digital content creator, and also a humanist. A very good afternoon to you, Peter Sen, and it's a pleasure to have you with me right here on the Reading News Analysis.
Yes, thank you so much for having me once more again. I hope I'm audible enough.
Very clear.
We are having rain here, so yeah, most of the droplets are falling from the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So I just hope to everyone listening, everyone is listening and everyone is hearing me quite clearly.
I can hear you quite clearly. Hey, Peterson, I can hear you quite clearly. I cannot hear the raindrops, although it's also raining this side, but not so heavily. It's just starting.
Nonetheless,
Peterson, it's really a pleasure to have you in. You came into my mind because, you know, you always embrace and talk about the informal sector, those that obviously do business in the informal sector, and you yourself having obviously been trained up or having been brought up by your mom who herself works in the informal sector. Now, just what do you think about the launch of this diagnostic of informality in Namibia? Now, having some ground work that has been worked on, research has been done to try and, of course, identify if there are going to be some policies that are going to be put in place. What are we exactly talking about when we talk about informality of the informal sector? But let me hear your sentiments on just when we're talking about informal sector, Peterson. What is it exactly that we're talking about from your opinion and obviously from your experience?
Yes, when I think of informal, first of all, I would like to appreciate the fact that there's strictly stipulated that it's a diagnostic, meaning it's still something developing, it's still something in search, it's still something that they are working on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really something that they say it is what it is, you know. But when I look into I really do appreciate the research. I do appreciate how they stated it out to be, that it's diagnostic. And I like the term that they used them. So when we look at informal, I believe informal settlement is the powerhouse of everyone and everything sitting in an office and everything that is running till today. So when we talk about informal settlement, we talk about the core heart of the core value that is driving formal economies today.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to informal settlements, I believe without informal settlements, there is no precedent. There is no company. There is no food. We'll be left dead and hungry. So informal settlement, as much as it sounds very informal, is a hidden gem to everyone's success.
Actually,
so in short, yes, in short, that's how I would really define informal settlement.
Mm-hmm. You say it's a hidden, yes. It's a hidden gem to everyone's success.
A hidden gem that drives every formality in this country or in the world at large, if I may say.
Mm. Now, of course, yes. Of course, studying the informal economy in Namibia is quite essential for developing informed policies that effectively or can effectively support informal workers and small businesses. Now, for you, Peterson, what are some of those pointers that you've you've identified? You know, that you would want to highlight to us that you think this should be areas which should be prioritized when those policies are maybe going to be put together to benefit the informal sector.
Yes, so I've really looked at, and I just, with this diagnostic policy research change and the whole analysis, honestly, I have even seen that most of the times, for example, I would give the Kapana, for example, if it wasn't for the tourism industry of the selling of Kapana and all that, I don't think that would be considered as a good thing towards the tourism market. But unfortunately, they have seen that that is something that is driving the economy. Those street vendors that attract tourists are the ones driving the formal economy. But however, I would like to suggest a few points where we really need to look to, or where the research needs to look to. So for now, I would really appreciate when they are hosting this event about the informal settlement.
Yeah.
Let the people themselves attend this event. Let the informal people attend these events themselves. And for me, it's personally, this is now very subjective. For me, I see no value in you hosting an event while you don't have street vendors there.
Yeah.
You understand what I mean?
I absolutely.
So the same, yes, I would really appreciate if this. I appreciate when they do policies, when they do all these things. I would want every policy around informal sector, around informal people, street vendors and so on. Whatever policy is being analyzed or changed, let everything be consultative and let everything be written in the language these street vendors understand. Give them a workshop on what the research is on.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not rushing through. I'm not jumping the gun. Maybe that is something really being processed or something still yet to develop after they have finalized their research.
Mm-hmm.
But more of when you are doing your research, let the people speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Let us hear from their side. Let us see. And even till today, street vendors are running around the town areas, the capital city, because the police are chasing them almost every single day.
Yeah.
Because they are, yeah, to seem as we are competing with the formal sector. But yes, but you find in the mornings, in the afternoons, when everyone knocks off, even the government workers hide from the street vendors. I'm telling you, you go to an informal settlement or informal sector, for example, the markets, you find DRN cars there. So if we are really speaking about informality,
mm-hmm.
then where do we really draw the lines of to say that it is really informal?
Mm-hmm.
If it's supporting and, you know, including all this government workers from the richest to the poorest, this sector is providing food for everybody on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So I would really like, yes, the, those are the focus areas. Really, I want them to look at really reaching to the people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Let them speak their story. Let them be part of the research. Let them be part of their questioning. Let them be part of the faith. When they're hosting this event, let them be there.
Mm-hmm.
Let these vendors be there. Let there be a translator. Because one thing that I don't understand, why is there a translator during things of like when there is a very big world summit or we are holding a conference, when we have French visitors, Portuguese visitors, we have always a translator on standby. But when you are hosting events of our Namibian nation ourselves, why can't we have translators that are available to translate in languages that the community might understand? We are rushing to technology. We have technology. I think that's one thing. We need to also educate these people, the informals. If they work with the informals, vendors themselves, let them, when you're hosting this summit, let them hear, let them be there, let them be present, ask them questions, translate for them. Let the translators be there and all that and all that.
Mm.
And I think it's so sad to see a conference that is being hosted on informal settlements without informal sector providers themselves within their attendance school.
Mm-hmm. What I do know is that the research was done in collaboration with some of the informal sector, some of the people working in the informal sector. Let me not say collaboration, that's the wrong terminology, but rather getting the information from them, hence why then they compiled and stuff like that. But I concur with you to say it would be nice if we could have at least 20 of them or from the informal sector attending the event, so that they can also have a feel to say, oh wait, we are actually being considered, that they're putting on the table certain document on diagnostic for informality that perhaps would be used in some very near future to help draw up policies and supportive registration that could benefit us. But you know, you spoke about how the informal sector people are always being chased from the streets, and I up to today I honestly do not understand. I don't know, maybe it's lack of I still do not understand. Of course, I understand that, of course, there's the informal sector and that there's the formal sector when it comes to conflicting of business. But I don't really see how conflicting it can be. If, for instance, there's a street vendor who is selling onions and tomatoes. If I, for myself, I'm very well acquainted with buying onions and tomatoes from the street, I can do all my grocery shopping of the other stuff that I cannot find on the street in ShopRite. But then, I would still go and buy the onions and tomatoes from the street vendor, whether they are outside ShopRite or perhaps I'm going to find them at Katutura, wherever. You get my point. So I really somehow still fail to understand why the law is quite very harsh, and I really want to use that word, very harsh towards our informal people, those that are in the informal sector, because considering that we are really benefiting from this, whether it's directly or indirectly, but we are benefiting from the informal settlement. We can't say we want to grow Namibia's economy if we are on the other side not combining or not being collaborative. You know, you get the Bank of Namibia alongside with the Ministry of Labor and alongside the other line ministries working together to come up with a report. Yeah. And then you have the city of Windhoek chasing the labor, the informal people from the streets, you know. I'm sorry for that, but then, you know, you get into it because I believe you have a better understanding on it, Peterson.
Yes. I do really concur with what you, I do really hear you. And I understand your point very clearly, and I know where you are coming from. And I think it has been so long, this sector has been forgotten and looked down upon. And to realize that they have finally seen that, honestly, we need to, you know, to do something about it. And for me, that's a great start, to be honest. As I said earlier, yes, you can consult the informal people. This research can include the informal people. But as I was saying, yes, maybe I'm jumping the gun. Maybe there will be a conference for them where they all can attend and be invited and be, you know, where they're approaching community councillors and all these people. So they have their own unique conflicts. and also be part of the conference, be part of, be there to see the keynote address, to see those slides that is being delivered there. I'm sure that, yes, they cannot provide everyone, but then, I mean, those that were part of the research should be accommodated, and also few from other regions. You know, even if they speak in their vernacular, there can be a translator. They can make options for that. But otherwise, I to be honest, I am happy with the diagnostic research that they have done, that they have established. And it's just really to look more on the informal sector, because I believe this is where skills are. Imagine, for you to have that mall, you need an architecture, but at the end of the day, the building cannot stand without that guy that puts the bricks together.
True.
It's because, and where do these people reside? In the informal sector.
Mm-hmm.
For you to have your beautiful wooden, table within your hotel, within your house, creative art structure, you need a vendor for that. For you to have your employees having energy to go to work tomorrow, you need a vendor for that. You need an informal sector for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we are missing, to say that the driving force, said over 1/4 of the population lives in informal sectors, or informal settlements, to be exact.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, informal settlers have the most power in this country. And it's a thing of, even if you look at voting now, imagine if there wasn't a Havana, there wasn't if all decide today, all the informal people that reside in informal settlement will not vote, I'm 100% sure there would actually be no one voting at all. Because at the end of the day, we contribute the highest amounts of vote. Because the whole, most of the population lives in informal settlement. But at the end of the day, we are the forgotten branch.
I hear you.
We need to get ourselves involved. The communities are dying. Culture is dying. People in informal settlement gave up on the government. They gave up on voting. And even though today you feel that, yes, they are involved, yet the whole discussion around the community is that we are all tired of voting. Yes, people have given. So I just feel they need to push themselves back into the community. Yes, we are not in a plan for them to get really, we cannot say we'll establish the whole informal settlement and, you know, create a formal one. It's somewhat, it will take months and months and months of years. If you look at how many people are operating, focusing on the economic side, it's impossible. But however, there's little we can do. The municipality, so much performative acts, I can say.
Mm-hmm.
They have very high performative acts, but action is lacking.
Mm-hmm.
I have hosted an interview with Becoming Health Namibia. Actually, we had an option of the cleaning up campaign. But I told the Becoming Health Namibia initiative to say that, hey, listen here, let's actually do this. Let's consult first the people that live. Where is the problem? And the highlight was mainly is the municipal services are very poor. The municipal services are very poor. Even if people wanted to invest in informal sectors, yes, there are really skilled businesses. There are skilled art, crafts. There are people that are really skilled that could even get foreign investments. But the problem is, what is the municipality really stretching on? Recently, we had workers that went on the strike.
Mm-hmm.
So we can really see that it's not about us, it's them. So I think they really need to put in their weight so we can really also increase this economic driving force. And when they are drafting the formalities and the informalities diagnostic plans, they should also consider that, to say that, yes, we also need to make sure we have informal sectors that are running properly. So so we can at least say, even though we cannot provide them proper housing, at least we have streets that can be clean, that have proper running sewage control system where anyone can walk in. We have developed initiative grassroots projects, not only Penduka. Let's have a Penduka in Havana. Let's have a Penduka in Okurangava. Mm. Let's also have, you know, a construction company within the informal settlement that upgrades and develops and sees. I mean, if you look at informal settlement, we can establish a working system for itself.
Actually,
yes, we can establish our own builders. We can establish our own electricians. They are here. And most of the times, to be honest, when we look at things such as solving waste, I'm sure most of the community members clean up themselves most of the time. Not entirely, but it gets exhausting because there is no support. Mm-hmm. Do you understand where I'm coming from? Mm-hmm. So it's just a thing. Even if a fire starts now, we'll wait for 5 minutes for the fire brigade to reach here. But who comes on the first initial response?
Yeah.
The people.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine training these people on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine training them on how to...
You're thinking.
Yeah. These are just these things that are... Since I've received the education from a vendor, an informal vendor,
mm-hmm.
I'm saying that today I'm able to contribute to one of the formal sectors. If it wasn't for an informal settler or informal vendor, I would have not received any formal education till today.
And you wouldn't be a qualified today? Teacher now.
Yes. Yes. And today, who am I contributing to the formal economy?
Mm.
So when they are busy chasing these people, they must remember that whoever is sitting, even the parliamentarians themselves, even whoever is making decisions today, they were once supported by a vendor. They were once buying bread from a vendor.
Mm-hmm.
They were once buying fruits from a vendor so they can have something into energies and to go to school. So I think we really need to see really where does the respect really come from. I think, to be honest, we are the driving force. The mine workers, vendors, after work, where do they eat? Street vendors. So really, the cycle starts with us. The cycle starts with us. For you to have that diamond on the table,
mm-hmm.
you somebody need someone that is uneducated,
yeah.
Yes, that is working in an that lives in an informal sector,
mm-hmm.
that has that workforce, and for him to have that health to come work tomorrow, he needs to buy that with that $10, the fat cake, and the relish that he's going to eat for him to go to work to get that power, produce that diamond. That today you sell on a high price to enrich yourself. So when you have that chain, at the end of the day also, that fat cake, it's Okomo. Okomo, who buys those flowers, mainly also street vendors, you understand. At the end of the day, they are also powering that sector.
Yeah.
I believe if you are hearing me. So we really need to look and say that, yes, these people, without this informal sector,
mm-hmm.
everything will collapse because this is where, when you are hosting a cultural, Olufuko, all these things, all this cultural, you need that vendor that knows traditional food.
Yeah.
We have neglected our own knowledge around our own,
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, it becomes performative because we only use these people during
when we need them.
Cultural events, yes, these tourism events, then we want to appreciate the vendors. It's not right. In my say, it is not ethical,
mm-hmm.
and it is a sign of poverty tourism.
Mm-hmm.
It's like mm-hmm. a show.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But
so,
mm-hmm.
yes, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
Yeah, we need to see through this really and really pull the weight through.
Yeah. You know what? I think, Santiani, we can all perhaps try to play more of our part. I do appreciate for you, when you do those, when you, as a digital content creator, when you really don't shy away from shining a light on our informal settlement or our informal sector, you know, just appreciating their work. And of course, I mean, this is the reality, you know. So, Peterson, thank you so much for sharing your sentiments with us and your contributions as well with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a great pleasure to be on this platform, to really have people that really can see that, yes, we are hearing from someone that has the experience.
Yeah.
And I need to appreciate the platform. Thank you so much, David.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Yes.
And of course, we pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We won't be too long. We'll be back and continue right with this news.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
And now let's take a listen to Kennedy Chivikwa of the Synergy Business and Consultancy speaking on the findings and the recommendations of the Namibia Diagnostic Informality.
Just to draw attention to some of them. So there are benefits and drawbacks. So it's not all bad. It's not all good. So, but it's there. So what would we conclude from the assessment? So I don't want to repeat what we have already mentioned. The 58% of the labor market, we have already elaborated on that. The second issue is the informality is driven by structural and institutional constraints, which we concluded that there are limited formal employment opportunities is one of the factors that drives informality. High compliance cost, and one of it also drives people to do business informally instead of doing registration and many other things. Weak enforcement of labor laws, meaning you can just put up a business and employ people. You don't have to pay social security contributions and comply with the minimum wage and many of these things. It also drives people to do this thing because it's much cheaper because this low or weak enforcement of labor laws. And the other one is, as we said, inadequate access to social protection. Why do we say social protection perhaps in a context is that most of these people are not registered as social security in case they are injured, in case they are going on maternity. So some ladies have to lose jobs because they are going on maternity. They don't have protection for that. If you are injured at work, you cannot be compensated. You don't have a pension. So most of these things. So then what is also very important to take note is the current legal and regulatory framework exclude other forms of work. For instance, independent contractors are missing in the Labor Act. The self-employed is not properly defined, but I don't want to go into that context. But it's not properly understood as well. What is meant by self-employed? If I have my business, but I also employ other people, am I considered self-employed or am I considered an employer? And when is it? So these terms sometimes are very difficult for an ordinary man on the street to understand. What is self-employed? And when am I employer? Can I be a self-employed and also be an employer at the same time? So all these things, all these definitions are, for instance, not properly explained in this legal framework for people to understand. The other, let me just probably because of time, just rush through some of them. Households are not not to be undermined in diagnosis informality. The households are very important because I said informal economy, one of the sectors is the household sector, because I mentioned earlier that there is informality within the formal sector. So, for instance, people have no contracts, although they are employed in a formal sector, and many other things. So there's also the issue of danger dynamics. There's a higher male to female ratio in urban than rural areas. There are more males in informal work than females at youth level. Again, if you look at the policy frameworks, it's very fragmented. But we will come back to that earlier on, later on. So the other factors also that we looked at and what we concluded is there's a disconnect between constitutional aspirations and implementation. If you look at what the Namibian constitution is saying and how it is being executed. And one of the issues is the coordination between the ministries. There's a silo approach to many, in many respects, and fragmentation that cause that disconnect between aspirations and implementation. And you will see when we are going to make a recommendation, why we are, for instance, making a recommendation for an agency. So the other issue is also the informality is both a challenge and opportunity. I just highlighted earlier in the previous presentation the employment opportunities and the contribution to the GDP. And then transitioning to formality requires a multi-dimensional coordinated approach between the ministries, social partners, to implement a coherent and inclusive policies. So those were the conclusions from the desktop study, which was the assessment of informality in Namibia. Now, we went into the field. Now, the two report is field work. Let me put it that way. And it's so we did a sectoral analysis. So, which focus on two sectors. Unfortunately, we could not do all sectors in Namibia. I will not go into how we selected this, but it's in the reports that you will find on the website as mentioned. So the two sectors selected were the agriculture, fishing and forestry, and food and accommodation services. So why did we do that? We wanted to look at the characteristics. We wanted to investigate the relationships. We wanted to look at specific factors and drivers, the characteristics, as I mentioned, the forms, the level, the legal and institutional framework. We wanted also to map the actors and policies to be able to make recommendations. So the field work, what we did is we had people in the field. In this regard, we were assisted by GIZ. You will see there that we looked at type of work, frequency. So, for instance, we have interviewed 242 tuck shop owners, 530 vendors. We look, it's beyond the, you will see many type of work that is covered. Farmers, we looked at nail technicians, we looked at builders, we looked, so the number and the frequency is also indicated there on the slide. So in total, the sample size existed of 2,080. So the selection was over 26 places in Namibia, urban and rural. We covered both. So it was not only in Windhoek or Shakati. It was divided. 26 places across Namibia. So you will see there we have municipalities, town councils, village councils. So we have for municipalities 720 questionnaires completed, town councils 560, village councils 160, which is a very good sample size for a study. We have discussed this with Namibia Statistics Agency, and I think our sample size is quite high according to the requirements for such a study. 2,080 is much higher. The requirement would have been around 600, 700 respondents. We are standing at 2,080, which is much, much, probably more than double. So it gives you an understanding of where we are. So we also divided this. We have made sure that when interviewing the respondents, we look at, we were at formal sector, informal sector, household sector, which covers the informal economy. And then we also did key informant interviews, which is 2,541. Informant interviews, we had 38. The sample size, you can see there, the regions that we have covered, almost all regions. Basically, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13, 14 regions. You see how many have we have interviewed, in fact, 2,541. That was ultimately what we have interviewed, although the plain sample was 2,080. So we went beyond the call of duty. So what did we find? Now, I said we focused on two sectors. Now, for the first one, agriculture, fishing, and forestry, what would we find? I will not go into much detail about the percentages, but you will see we have indicated 70% of our population are in agriculture. We looked at forestry, for instance. We looked at the economic impact. The policy alignment that we looked at is probably just to look at that. We are strategically aligned with the national development objectives as outlined in Vision 2030 and NDP 6 and the Harambe Prosperity Plan. I'm not talking about the achievements, but the alignments, okay? And these frameworks underscore the sector's critical role in reducing poverty and so forth. And then the opportunistic survey we have undertaken, you will notice from graph that we focus on the highest number that we obtained was from on-account workers, people that are self-employed. Most of them account for the largest number, and then employees. So we looked at owners of the businesses And then we also looked at workers. And then the employers was a little bit low because our focus was to look more at the people that were impacted, I mean, majority by informality. The prevalence and characteristics of informality, the employees, we find there that the average income for farming is 1,600, fishing 2,840, horticulture 1,750. We indicated the standard deviation, the minimum and the maximum. So the conclusion is the verbal contracts, especially for horticulture, is much higher. The percentage is around close to 100%, meaning most of these people work without contracts in horticulture, most of them. Farming is around.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. As jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet, kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
In horticulture, most of them. Farming is around 58-57%. Fishing around 48-49%. We have verbal contracts.
Okay, and that was Kennedy Chivikwa, who was giving the findings and part of the findings and the recommendations of the Namibia Diagnostic Informality. And of course, there's documents which are 3 pages, are available. Step 1, step 2, and step 3 are available on the Bank of Namibia's website, the Ministry of Industrialization and Trade's website, the Ministry of Labor, Industrial Relations and Employment Creation's website, and also the United Nations website. Should you be interested in getting them and then educating yourself more on them as well. And for me, I think when we talk about the informal sector or diagnostic of informality in Namibia, it's an unending journey, or this could be beginning of something that is tangible on ground that one we can touch. To say when we're talking about informal sectors, it's just the beginning of what should be put in place in terms of policies, in terms of registration, in terms of the framework. Somebody relying on their business being in the informal sector and of course employing other people and contributing well to the economy of Namibia, because they are keeping livelihoods going. They are keeping livelihoods going with what they are doing. And so when, for instance, it's a woman, because women are mostly in this sector, then she goes into maternity and there is no income coming in. And of course, those that are depending on her, and also the employees that she has probably employed are also then, not really being sustained, properly as it should be. So it's something that really we need to get into action with, or those that are at the heart of policymaking need to really consider and of course appreciate, our informal sector, because it really is very much contributing, towards our livelihoods and of course towards Namibia's economy. Now with that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly to bring you news beyond the borders of Namibia. And should you be interested in partaking in the news bulletin, dial in on 083-288-401.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe udite opoewe ekukulile oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana ono ngeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evito danjuka okukwetera oipindi konu konda doinawa nuneudo otukwetera o special angenda shake ngejefa omarudi dayoloka okone ushenjife nawa nokumona oijamoiri nawa ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora esatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu omafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. And now for news beyond the borders of Namibia, we're starting off in South Africa, whereby the government of South Africa is set to reduce South Africa's inflation target to 3%.
Has decided to reduce South Africa's inflation target to 3% with a 1 percentage point tolerance band. Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana says the 1 percentage point band provides flexibility to accommodate any unexpected inflationary shocks. Godongwana presented the medium-term budget policy statement at a sitting of the National Assembly at the Good Hope Chamber in Parliament yesterday. The Finance Minister joins us now to discuss his medium-term budget statement. Minister, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you very, very much. And I do have to, I suppose, start on a high note, because there was a lot of good news coming out of yesterday's budget. The midterm budget. And I think we needed this.
Thank you very much. I also think there's been too much negativity. At least I'm glad that we've been able to generate some positive positivity within the South African society.
Yeah. I mean, we'll start off here looking at the state's primary budget surplus. I mean, it's set to grow to 68.5 billion rand in the 2025-26 financial year. Does this mean that the National Treasury's fiscal strategy for South Africa is well on track?
Our strategy is well on track. You will recall we've always said that we will reach the peak of the debt to GDP in 25-26 financial year. What that means, we needed to build building blocks to achieve that. And those building blocks include having a primary surplus. By its very nature, it then have an impact on a debt trajectory. That's what has happened.
Yeah. I mean, we also look at stabilizing state debt, and that's been a great worry. It really has been for many watching on. Stabilizing debt at 77.9% of GDP. Does this mean that Treasury is on a strong trajectory to reach that surplus of 2.5% of GDP in 2028-29 as projected?
Yeah. I mean, in economics, they use a term called assuming everything remains constant, assuming that there are no changes or shocks in the economy, that's the trajectory we think we'll be able to reach. And again, I make the qualification, assuming that everything remains constant.
Well, that's what we can hope for. I mean, the one thing that I think took a lot of people by surprise, but perhaps not by surprise, but one where we need to focus a little bit on, is the factors influencing government to reduce South Africa's inflation target to 3%. I mean, this is something we haven't heard in years. And I mean, this is again, another positive move. So perhaps talk to us about the factors that led to this decision.
Reading this morning, some of people were criticizing but there's absolutely a lack of understanding what has been happening in inflation in South Africa. As we speak, inflation is already hovering around 3% for starters. Secondly, inflation is good for the economy because inflation is not visible.
Okay.
Just the interest rate.
Minister, this is such an important point, and I seem to...
...is going up. Then the central bank is bound to increase interest rate to contain inflation. But if inflation is going down, the central bank also follows suit by reducing interest rates. A reduction in interest rate has got positive spin-off in both for the investment community in the sense that the borrowing costs come down.
Mm-hmm.
And also for households like myself and you, because it reduces the cost of living. Let me just make a particular example. Young people now who are coming into the market, who have just got some jobs, who want to have been first-time buyers for cars or first-time buyer for an apartment, the cost of borrowing then comes down and it reduces increases their ability to be able to purchase these assets.
Now, unions disagree with you, though. They argue against a lower inflation target on the grounds that it would curtail economic growth. How do you convince them otherwise? How do you convince them about the benefits of a lower inflation target?
Lower inflation will increase growth. The logic of that argument, it suggests that your transition towards a lower inflation will be accompanied by raising higher interest rates in order to force inflation down. That argument is not sustainable in the current environment in South Africa because already inflation is already hovering around 3%. What that means, in fact, the central bank has said in its July's statement that there's a possibility of about 5 cuts in interest between now and interest rate between now and 2027. Therefore, a cut in interest rate cannot be a constraint to growth. So that's where this argument becomes flawed.
Yeah. And the reality is, and I mean, you speak to cuts because we may see the effect as early as next week, because next week is a decision on interest rates. And there is, especially after hearing this midterm budget, there's great expectations that there will be another cut coming of 25 basis points next week. So we're on this trajectory already.
Also predicting a cut in interest rate. I'm not saying there's going to be a cut.
No, it's a prediction.
The governor would kill me if I say that. That is area of work.
Yeah.
But all I can say is that all of us, we expect in the current environment, there's no basis why they should not be cutting interest rate.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, these are all sort of predictions and we're hearing what economists are saying after this, that they do expect.
The global economy. Let's now take a listen to the global economy versus South Africa's economy with Professor Patrick Bond.
Further. Prof. Patrick Bond, thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. The medium-term budget policy statement is often an opportunity for us to have an assessment of what the global economic outlook looks like, following, of course, the February budget and how that influences, how those external indices influence our medium-term outlook. And one such indicator is global economic performance. The IMF puts out that figure this time of the year, and we rely on that to adjust and temper our own expectations. The global economy is going to be growing at 3.2%, adjusted downwards from 3.3% over the medium term. South Africa will only be growing at 1.2% this year, as well as 1.8% over the medium term. It seems awfully unambitious for us to say, hey, the world is growing at double the rate we are, but we should accept this. What are we just simply not getting right to catch up with the rest of the world?
Well, thank you very much for having me, Oliver, and greetings to the viewers. I think that's right. The world economy.
It has extraordinary
volatility at the moment because of the AI bubble that Minister Gonagwana mentioned, but also Donald Trump's very, very unusual way of negotiating. We were bearing the brunt of it, but other countries even worse, like Brazil and India, which got 50% tariffs. And the disruption of world trade is one of the reasons for continual reassessment of whether the economy can, continue to purr along. We've seen global value chains broken. We've seen the trade war from Donald Trump against China reverberate here, basically wrecking a big chunk of our steel industry as China has moved the exports that it couldn't sell in the U.S. To South Africa, and therefore ArcelorMittal unable to compete, closing some of its foundries. And we're seeing that with new tariffs being put by South Africa on China for steel, for washing machines, for nuts and bolts, for tires. And I think this is just going to continue while we have in the presidency a very volatile man, and particularly in financial markets like New York Stock Exchange, AI being an extraordinary overvaluation, and indeed South Africa's own stock market also terribly overvalued. If you use the standard definition, market capitalization to GDP, we're basically third highest in the world. So those are some of the things that would make us, I'd say, prefer more caution in dealing with
care that helps you care for others. That's the Basic Mental Health First Aid course, free for NHP members. You'll learn how to spot early signs of mental or emotional distress in friends, family, or colleagues, and how to guide them to the right support before small struggles become bigger problems. Learn more and register for free at nhp.com.na. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Okay, let's continue with that overview on the global economy versus South Africa's economy. Of course, Finance Minister Enoch Godukwana has decided to reduce the inflation target to 3%. Earlier this year, the Reserve Bank governor also expressed the bank's preference to target inflation at 3%, a move that was lamented by the Finance Minister Godukwana, arguing that policy pronouncement would come from the National Treasury. Now, Godukwana says that the 3% inflation target is expected to limit government finances in the short term, but also reduce the cost of living and borrowing for households. Let's now take a listen to political economist Professor Patrick Bond, just highlighting on that as well.
Even justifying a higher or tighter exchange control so we can have a lower interest rate, so that this debate about inflation targeting doesn't become one where extreme low inflation that is being targeted justifies higher rates.
Would we be able to absorb Trump's global tariff assault a little bit differently, a little bit better, if our political economy was differently arranged?
Yes, and especially if we could really find the BRICS working together. You might remember, Oliver, on September 8th, the president of Brazil, host of the BRICS this year, Lula, who's now hosting the climate summit. But 2 months ago, he tried to put us all together as the BRICS countries into some alignment. And unfortunately, one by one, not only the five original BRICS, but most of the others were basically divided and ruled, and Lula now being the most recent. So we didn't see a collective response, the kind of response that China showed the capability to fight back and to put a major threat to stop rare earth minerals export. And in fact, Guedes Montes had said much the same back in February, March, saying that we should be conscious that South Africa has platinum and chrome that the U.S. needs, and we're the main suppliers, so we could also do something to threaten those supplies as a counterforce. Instead, we've been very obsequious, and it's fairly clear in the last few days where Donald Trump is showing such enormous disrespect for the G20 process here, that the nice guy approach, the attempt to have a game of golf with Donald Trump just isn't working.
So if we're not going to be obsequious, as you put it, it means we would have to be recalcitrant in one way or the other to Donald Trump's attacks. Which would it be? And I want to frame it around what you said there at the tail end, around the commodities boom. We've seen a commodities boom in this cycle, similar to what we saw, although not at the same scale, to what we saw when Russia had invaded Ukraine in 2021. We've seen it something similar now with Donald Trump's tariff onslaught on the rest of the world.
Meanwhile, International Finance Corporation boosts local currency lending across Africa.
Across Africa, borrowing in dollars remains out of reach for many. And when it happens, it often comes at heavy cost. That's why the International Financial Corporation, IFC, is taking a different approach, lending in local currencies. Speaking at the Africa Financial Summit in Casablanca, Morocco last week, IFC Managing Director Maktay Diop said lending in local currencies is now rapidly taking root across the continent.
We are increasingly making loans in local currency. Today, 30% of what the IFC does is in local currency. We will continue to do this.
In September this year, the IFC unveiled a landmark $10 million equivalent local currency loan to Vision Fund, a microfinance institution in Ethiopia, to support small businesses, many of them women-owned and based in rural areas.
For countries like Ethiopia, IFC's push for local currency lending couldn't come at a more critical time. Ethiopia is currently in talks with its private bondholders after defaulting on its sovereign debt last year, having already restructured about $8.4 billion under the G20 common framework. The local currency lending, as a result, could give the country's private sector a much-needed lifeline.
Experts say local currency lending reduces the risk of foreign exchange shortage and could help mobilize long-term savings and investments.
Developing country economies are relatively abundant in labor, but short in capital. So capital is usually a scarce resource. Entities like the IFC that work with the private sector, they could choose to invest or lend using foreign currency, or they could choose to do that in local currency. Borrowing in local currency would remove that risk of generating the liquidity to pay back. So we'll only be concerned about the interest rate in our income in paying back this debt.
For the local currency loan program to be effective, however, Dr. Tedros says African countries must improve the efficiency of their monetary policy.
Prudent management of your monetary policy is essential to ensure that the country as a whole benefits from such programs, to make sure that these funds are utilized in the best way possible. But it is a very welcome, decision, given that a lot of, developing countries, most African countries, have been facing, macroeconomic shocks, because of course, initially COVID, and then high inflation, and then different conflicts like the Ukraine-Russia war and others have been straining balance of payments of developing countries. And so foreign exchange comes in short supply. These kinds of schemes allow the financing of domestic firms in these countries while removing the worry of necessarily, generating the foreign exchange needed to repay these kinds of loans.
The IFC hopes local currency lending will also allow African banks to access vital dollar resources while strengthening the corporation's equity and investment ties across the continent.
Many commercial banks need dollar resources and have significant local currency deposits. We are in discussions with some banks to grant us access to a local currency line of credit so that we can provide them with dollar resources and use that line of credit to invest in equity in the country.
Local currency lending could usher in a new era for African finance, empowering small businesses, attracting global capital, and helping local economies grow stronger. Beka Toma for CGTN, Addis Ababa.
Malawi imposes export ban in order to boost local mineral value.
Malawi may have a largely developing mining sector. It still extracts important mineral resources, including sapphires, rubies, and other gemstones. Now, though, an immediate export ban has been placed on those, along with other rare earth elements, including rutile, coal, and uranium. The ban was made by the country's president, Peter Mutharika, and aims to create a platform for value addition of the resources, which can boost economic growth.
the value addition, the processing right here. There are a lot of other benefits apart from employment and whatever. The owners of the resources, they are doing something that they should have done maybe 15, 20, 30 years ago, you know, because we need to take control. We need to take charge of our own resources.
The policy targets key deposits like the Kasia rutile site in Ilongwe and the Kankankunde rare earth site in Balaka, which include graphite, bauxite and gemstones. Like many other African countries, local beneficiation is seen as an untapped economic contributor, which should be exploited for the benefit of the country. The purpose of the ban is designed to promote local industrialization, create jobs, and ensure Malawi benefits from its natural resources by processing it domestically.
On the part of large-scale miners, I think the export ban is important. It is important because Malawi needs to safeguard its mineral resources.
For now, some exemptions have been made, and the ban does not apply to natural resources that have already gone through processing or value addition within the country. Gravis Andrews, CGTN.
Ethiopian market faces price adjustments amid currency shifts.
Safaricom has reported a 23% reduction in losses in its Ethiopian operations, as well as an increase in revenues and net earnings. But in the 3 days since those results came out, its share price has fallen by nearly 5%. Now, between April and September, Safaricom reported an 8% rise in group revenue, with the Ethiopian unit tripling its revenue to nearly $48 million. Now, compared to the same period a year earlier, losses in Ethiopia narrowed to $223 million. That, however, did drag net earnings for the company as a whole down from $450 million to $225.7 million. When I spoke to Safaricom's chief financial officer, Dilip Pal, I started our conversation by exploring the impact of currency fluctuations on the company's results. The firm is no longer having to use hyperinflation accounting, he says, but the impact from the birr's 20% fall against the American dollar so far this year is not the only currency hit on the books.
Of course, if you now convert that into dollar terms, with the depreciation, I mean, last half year, I mean, just before the currency reforms, we're about 57 to a dollar. And I think we closed September with about 114 and March with about 125. And September this year, we closed at 146 to a dollar, which is like about 17% decline, devaluation. And then about 33% devaluation in the euro. I mean, there is something happened also globally on euro. I don't know if you have noticed or not. Euro became very stronger compared to dollar. And it has impacted, in fact, Kenya results as well. We have to take also a currency hit on account of euro. Although dollar to Kenya shilling remained very, very stable.
How much exposure do you have, at least with respect to long-term credit on the euro?
So there are two parts of the impact that comes in. One from the long-term debt. That's in dollar. So that's not a problem. Problem in Ethiopia, because we have the currency depreciated 17%, but not to the extent of euro, which depreciated 33%. But the majority of our dues outside of what we pay in ETB in Ethiopia, both for Huawei and Nokia, is in euro. You know, they are not allowed to accept, you know, this is a geopolitical problem, that they cannot accept dollar.
So we're still sticking to the break-even target for 2027?
Yeah, that's correct. And I reiterated that yesterday. And I said the questions was more of what gives you that confidence and how do you think that's going to play out? So our point is, our commercial execution in terms of, because we're adding more sites, just for your information, around 400 sites were out of bound for data. So these are called, data barred sites because of some security reasons in Amhara region. So end of September, pretty much all are now operational. So you are able to actually sell, because our proposition was data. So you are not able to really acquire new customers. So we're able to do that, and we're also adding new sites. So with all of that, we're saying, okay, H2 will be better than H1 for Ethiopia, and the level of currency depreciation which has happened in first half is not likely to be in that level. And then the other part, a very, very important part which I have not spoken about, is we did expect some market repair in terms of price ups, industry as a whole. And we are not the only one. I think we mentioned it, but you saw the Ethiopia Communication Authority instituted study, which is the World Bank study, which has been referred. By the way, this was by the regulator whose institute asked them to look at, after 3-4 years of operations and liberalization, what's actually the industry scenario. And actually, we welcome that report, because some of the things that we mentioned before, spoke about before, is what also coming in that report.
Because that sort of feeds into your cost base in Ethiopia, especially with respect to wholesale NTR
absolutely
termination costs.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Because what that report, 33 pages, made for really interesting reading. And one of the main arguments they were making was that the MTR rates, the mobile termination rates that Ethiotel was charging Safaricom, didn't quite make sense. They're way, way overpriced relative to the cost of actually providing the service.
And that is just one of the problem. The other issue is that operators, industry selling services at lower than the retail price, than the lower than the cost, which is actually not allowed by any regulator anywhere in the world, because then what are you doing for, you know, to the industry?
Effectively, you're burning shareholder capital.
You're basically burning. So I think.
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Voters Education or Voters Preparation Program with Bishop Lucas Katinda. From Indafa, happy Juju. It is goodbye, and have yourself a wonderful Thursday ahead.